Just to give you a short note on the people we have in the room.
Yes.
We have, so most of us are, well, we have two different sets of people. People who are on our research department, which should be more or less like your library, so they produce information aimed at, mainly aimed at the members of parliament. And
okay.
We also have two people from our communication department, and they are already in the process of doing infographics for our website. And
okay.
We also have two people from our editions department, and they are responsible for the visual line of the parliament and everything that is connected with the visual production in the parliament.
Okay. So publications and the website, things like that?
Publications, that's it. Yes, that's okay. Publications, yes.
Just out of interest, how many MPs are there in the Portuguese parliament?
Sorry?
I'm just interested, how many MPs do you have?
230.
Okay, so it's a smaller number than we have, 650.
Yes.
So you probably end up doing more in-depth work for a smaller number of people, I would imagine.
Yes.
Okay. So let me know when you're ready, and I will switch over to PowerPoint.
We're ready to start. You can start whenever you
Great.
Wish. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you very much, Dalila, for arranging this meeting. My name's Oliver Hawkins. I'm a statistical researcher in the House of Commons Library, where I lead on data science. I'm going to be presenting today with my colleague, Carl Baker, who's also a statistical researcher in the library, where he leads on mapping and geography. So over the last few years, our approach to data visualization has changed quite significantly. Sort of 7 or 8 years ago, we were working exclusively with Word and Excel. And then sort of in the last few years, we started experimenting with new ways of visualizing data. That started off as quite an organic process. And then it's become more formal as we've turned some of the things we experimented with into a more explicit guidelines and processes. So what we're going to do today is go through the kind of journey that we've been on and show you some of the things that we've done. And I would stress, it's still very much in flux. I think we're learning and trying things all the time. So some of the things we'll show you have become established ways of working. Some of them are still quite experimental, and we're still finding ways to make them work. But before we get into the actual data visualization, I'm just going to take a moment to set the scene and explain how we work with statistics in the library. So there, in the House of Commons Library, we have 8 core research sections, 6 of which cover exclusively policy. So that's things like international affairs and home affairs and social policy and science and environment and so on. There are 2 statistics sections. There's social and general statistics, which is where Carl works and where I tend to sit, and there's economic policy and statistics, and all of the statistical research in the library is carried out by those 2 sections. Sorry, I should be there. So those are our 2 stat sections. Now, we produce both private and public briefing material. About 80 to 90% of our work is answering confidential inquiries from MPs' offices, and around 10 to 20% of our work involves producing public briefing material. And that includes essentially books, briefings that are published as PDFs on the website, online articles, digital tools, and public talks. And those 2 things are linked. The confidential work and the public work are linked. Firstly, because the principal target audience for our public briefing material is MPs and their staff. We share it with the wider public, but we're still very much aiming what we're doing at MPs. And what we choose to produce publicly is informed by the confidential inquiry work. So our public work tends to cover topics that we know MPs are most interested in from their inquiries and the answers to the most common questions we're asked. Now, there have been there's lots of different ways in which the work of the library is evolving, and some recent developments that have influenced how we do data visualization are we had a redesign of our in-house visualization style in the last couple of years. We've had an in-house style for as long as I've been in the library, which is since 2011, but it went through a complete overhaul, and Carl's going to talk you through how we did that. We've really developed our mapping capability. Again, this is mainly through Carl's work, sort of experimenting with software like QGIS and finding out different ways we can use that to expand the range of mapping visualizations that we can do. There's the data science program, which is what I lead on, and that's really about computational statistics, so using programming languages to do data analysis, and how that changes both the kind of visualizations that you produce and the way that you produce them. It opens up the scope for things like automation and reproducibility, and it means that rather than sort of remaking the same graphics over and over again by hand, you can create pipelines to extract data from different sources and generate them, regenerate new charts of the same data as more and more data gets published. And then we have commonslibrary.parliament.uk, which is the web address of our own website. 5 or 6 years ago, we didn't have a separate website for the library. There was the main Parliament website, but Commons Library, I'll show you some of the stuff on there a bit later on, gives us an online venue for publishing. And the main reason for that, the motivation for that, is really to so that we can produce sort of shorter, more news-related briefing pieces that are sort of 1,000 to 2,000 words long, rather than the substantive, you know, 20 or 30 page briefing paper. It lets us be more kind of responsive to what's happening in the news, so that if a subject suddenly becomes of interest to MPs, we can get some core information to them. The fact that that platform exists for us gives us new opportunities for data visualization, which we're starting to explore. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to come out of the presentation now and hand over to Carl, who's going to take you through the redesign of the in-house visualization style and the mapping capability. And then I will show you some of the stuff related to the data science program in the second half of the presentation. So, Carl, if I... where has my thing gone? So if I stop presenting, Carl, you can switch back over.
Okay. Yep. I've just unmuted myself, so I'll click present, and hopefully that will work. Okay. So with any luck, my presentation should be showing now. Is that?
Yeah, I think it's working. It's loading.
Yes, yes.
Good stuff. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Carl, you're muted. Carl, you're mute. Oh dear. Okay. Can you hear me in Portugal?
Yes, we can, but we can't listen to Carl. We can't hear.
Yes. No. We've identified a problem. Carl's just going to need to come. I think his computer's frozen.
Okay.
He's just going to leave and come back in, I think.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. Don't worry. I'll hang one moment. Carl, I've told them that you're going to need to reboot.
We can listen to Carl, but from a very from afar. We can. It's not. The sound's not good.
Okay. Okay. I think he's just working on it. Sorry about this.
No problem. It's okay.
I don't know how things are with with you, but with us it's patchy. Some things they're very good at, some things they're not so good at. We still struggle with the desktops. And in fact, one of the things I was going to talk about a bit later is that we find that the things we want to do often come into conflict with the way that IT departments are used to working. You know, IT departments want to say, here are the software tools you need to do your job, now go ahead and do it and don't bother us. Whereas because we're trying to experiment a lot of the time, we found that we will often need to keep going back to the software, to the IT people, to say, we need to install this piece of software. We just want to try this piece of software.
I can't say anything because I have IT people in the room. But let's just say I can feel your pains.
am I back?
Oh, you're back. Fantastic.
Okay, I think I will do that again, but this time I will just present screen rather than trying to get it to present specifically a PowerPoint. So let's do that. Okay. That might probably work better. It seemed like I've got a dual screen set up, and when I tried to get it to present just that
yes,
that window, it didn't enjoy that. But hopefully now we should be presenting,
yes,
back
are.
On the present. So fingers crossed that we get there this time. Okay. So as I was saying, Ollie's been describing some of the changes we've been through in recent years, it's worth emphasizing that data visualization is not a new concept for us. We've got colleagues in this section who've been thinking about how best to visualize data for a matter of decades, but I think what's changed in the last few years is a better availability of technology, both sort of hardware and software, so our ability to think a bit more carefully about exactly how we want our visualizations to look, and also to present them on the web, which is something that hasn't been possible until recent years. So there's two things I'm going to talk through before showing you some examples of our outputs now. One is about different kinds of products that we use that we wouldn't have used before, as Ollie has already touched upon, and the other is about principles behind the change in the visual style that we've adopted. So Ollie has mentioned that the old model of working in our statistics sections more or less exclusively involved using Microsoft Excel and Microsoft Word to present data to produce documents that we would either publish online or send to members of parliament and their staff, and almost all of the visualization work that we would have done in the past would have been done in Excel. Now, if we took a couple of representative examples from 5 years ago, this is what you would have expected to see in our publications, sort of kind of flat and well presented tables, and nevertheless dry and not that visually inviting. This is the sort of thing that you would still see in a lot of government publications, and people who don't think they have to try and make their information visually attractive. This is an example of a chart that we would have put in a briefing paper a few years ago. It's a few steps removed from a default Excel chart, but it's still very much focused around white spaces, black lines, and monochromatic bars. And in terms of charts and tables, we've gone on a bit of a journey to make things a bit more visually consistent and visually attractive over the last couple of years. But it's not just been about style, it's also about form and how we produce things. So we, instead of just using Excel now, we have a bunch of other technologies that we use for producing charts, tables, and other visual images, graphics, maps. So for charting, some people are now using technologies like R, the statistical programming language, and other programming languages like Python, D3, the JavaScript library, and Power BI, which is a Microsoft software which allows you to create dashboards. And I think Ollie might be talking about that a bit more in a little while. For mapping, we've mostly been using an open source piece of software called QGIS, which is excellent, very, very powerful, and has allowed us to create a lot of mapping capability where we didn't really have any before. And for mapping online, which is something that we're doing but still sort of finding our way with a bit, we've been using Leaflet, which I think again is a JavaScript library, but Ollie might correct me on that one. We've also introduced a number of sort of steps to touch up and improve images, like using software like Inkscape and GIMP to produce images for the web, and to produce graphics. So all these, introducing all these technologies for different sorts of projects have allowed us to expand our horizons and to do things that we might not have been able to do before. So whereas we might only have used Excel in the past, now it's a mixture. People will still use Excel on a daily basis for both data processing and data visualization, but we have lots more options available to us. So when we're doing urgent work for an MP or just standard charts for a briefing paper, we might still just use Excel. Lots of us will, for many of our projects, still find Excel to be perfectly adequate. And by using the right styles and taking the right processes, we can create great looking charts or tables for briefings or the web. But often we'll want to go further and do something that isn't possible in Excel. So we might use R to process our data or even to create charts. So we might use QGIS to produce maps. When we've put things together, we might create composite graphics in a software like Inkscape to produce SVGs or scalable vector graphics. So rather than just putting things into Word, we might then produce images that we can use on the web. Sometimes those will be PDFs, sometimes they'll be images that we'll use on our Commons Library website. So what we have now is a much more multifaceted varied approach to data visualization, where there was more or less one track before. There's lots of different options that we would use. So that's the technology side. On the other hand, I said that we've updated our visual style from the sort of the monochromatic approach to something a bit different. So the principles behind when we updated the visual style were as follows. We wanted to have a stronger visual identity. I mentioned that some of the table and chart I showed you before were quite generic, things you might expect to see in any government publication. We wanted our work to have a bit more of a strong feel, so that when our customers see it, they know that it's a piece of Commons Library work. We also wanted to have a consistent approach to colours and fonts. While our work has always been built around green, because green is the House of Commons colour, we didn't always have consistency around what kinds of greens we were using, and fonts were chosen from defaults rather than on any consistent basis. We wanted to be more engaging. There can be sometimes a trade-off in data visualization between making things look nice and making them clear, and we try to find the sort of good middle ground where you're producing clear and understandable graphics which are nevertheless visually attractive. We also wanted them to be easy to understand, and to introduce a style that was flexible enough that even though we had a default, we could use different colours and styles and different contexts to get a point across where the need was there. So we also wanted an approach that wasn't going to be dependent on a particular technology. So while we do have colour palettes for Excel, we have an approach that we can use in other software as well. So this is an example of what you might see if you look at a table in one of our publications now. There are a few main changes. One is that we now use background shading, so a shaded box for most of our chart and table work, and that's used in cases where you want an object to stand out from its background. I don't know how well these colours will show on your screen. I know that using projecting technology can often mean that things don't show as they should. I think Ollie will probably send you these slides afterwards so you can you'll get a better idea of exactly what it's supposed to look like. So apologies if things are not displaying as
no,
they should
no,
be.
No, it's okay. We can see the shades and
good
colors.
Stuff. Yeah. So what we should be seeing is that the background of the main table has a very faint green shading, and then and then there's a strong green shading in the title. So these are the standard colors we use for charts and tables. And here's an example of a chart with the same sort of approach. And both of these have aspects that we change depending on the chart. We wouldn't always use grid lines. We would sometimes use multiple different colours of green. But these all have a few of the virtues that I talked about above. It's a stronger visual identity in that it stands out more from just a default chart. It uses agreed and consistent colours. In particular, the dark green that we use in the background here is one we use in everything that we can, and it's got a consistent approach to fonts. So those are the two basic cases, but we have a lot of variation depending on the different different use you want to put things to. So we regard a lot of the stylistic decisions in these basic charts as being negotiable. And for instance, in this one, you can see we've got different color greens in the chart, directly labeled lines, which is good for interpreting the data. But also this one doesn't have a dark green banner head. And depending on what you're going with, that might be a better way to go. This example shows using a different color, specifically an orange, to draw attention to where there's a deficit between the trained strength of the UK Armed Forces and the requirement. So using color in a meaningful way. So these are all examples of how we both build on the green palette and add extra things to portray visual meaning. And one of the key principles that we, I think, we're trying to abide by in all our charts and tables is that any additional visual element must be performing some kind of role. So we'll discourage people from putting orange on their chart unless it means something particular, because that sort of color carries a connotation and people will think that they're looking at something that's negative or bad. So we want to sort of draw on that and have people draw that understanding. We also produce things that look quite different. So where colours can have a meaning, we will go away from the green altogether and try and focus on those things. So this is an example of some charts to do with obesity, where it uses certain shades of yellow, orange and green to show the difference between different age groups in terms of the percentage that are obese or overweight. So what's similar to this one and the previous one? Well, we've still got background shading and we're still using the same font and title standards, but we vary the colours where it's necessary to make the point. Here's an example of one where we're still using the base green palette, but using a heat map style approach to convey some information about the data. So this chart is showing monthly data for the percentage of patients in our hospitals who are spending a long time in emergency departments, so waiting times in hospitals. The rows show years and the columns show months, and the transition between green to yellow to orange is intended to show how performance over time has worsened. And so you can see, you know, the earlier years are very green, and then very quickly in 2016 it becomes very orange, showing that performance and waiting times have lengthened and people are waiting longer in hospitals. So this is an example of using colour to make a point that might be harder to see if you just had a line chart. And these are all intended as examples to show how we go beyond our basic styles in making a visual point where it's useful to do so. Other examples, where we're producing summary pages or graphics for the web, we'll sometimes produce an inverted version of our original colour scheme. So here we've got the original scheme where you have light green as the background colour and dark green as the foreground colour. For some web charts, we find it more can be more striking to have the dark green as the background colour and then white as the foreground colour. But they're still very much identifiable as the same sort of style, but using the style in a different way. Now, all the examples I've shown you so far have been made in Excel, sometimes with some adjusting in other software or putting together in Inkscape to make into a graphic. But we do use other technologies as well. So these charts are some charts about changes in population and age structure in cities and villages in England. But these were made using R, and Ollie can tell you about how that's done if you're interested. But the point is that they were made to the same sort of colour scheme and chart style, which emphasises the point about the style being technology agnostic that I was making before. It's not simply an Excel style, but rather something we can apply to other contexts, such as making charts in other software like R. So these charts show, if you look at the middle charts, that England's core cities have far more young people. They have this spike at people aged 20 to 29, whereas in villages you get a bit of a bump in the middle in middle-aged people. So they're intended to show how the age structure of a city and village differ. Two more examples of things which are a bit more hybrids.
where some aspects were produced in Excel and then they were put together in a different piece of software to make into a graphic. Both of these use elements of our visual style, but then pick different colours in order to be relevant to the theme. So this is an example that my colleague Noel made. You probably can't read all the text here, but I think we do have a version of this available online. But even though you can't read all the text, you can probably get the main point just from looking at the graphic. It shows how the USA and the USSR and their stock of nuclear weapons have changed over time. And there's lots of extra elements added to provide context. On the right, we've got some text. At the bottom, we've got who was the presidents and leaders of the USA and the USSR. And then lots of call-outs on the chart itself showing different events that happened. So this one says 1959 nuclear tests banned in America. This one says 1993 Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. So a lot of information conveyed in a little space. There's a couple of other things to draw attention to here. At the bottom right, we have our House Commons Library logo and Commons Library Twitter handle. Where we're producing graphics that we intend to be shared on the web, we will make sure that those elements are included. And that's to ensure that if it's shared without context, then it can be tracked back to us. We've had a few instances before where we produced graphics that didn't have sort of our visual handles on, and they were shared widely, but then nobody knew that we made them, which is a bit of a shame. So we're sure to do that now, so that our identity is on these graphics. That doesn't matter so much when we're just producing something that will go into a briefing, like a generic chart like this one. But if we're making something that we intend to be shared on the web that we might use on Twitter, then we will put that that identifier on. Another example of something that's a bit simpler but uses different colours because of the topic matter is this chart on tuberculosis. This is an example where I made this chart and thought that using green may not be appropriate for a matter that people consider to be it's a negative thing, looking at the tuberculosis. It's important to be aware of when the colours you choose are going to carry a certain connotation. I'm told that people over associate green with grass and grassy areas or with good things. So it's especially on maps, I find this, if you use green to shade an area, people are going to think that you're highlighting something good, so you have to be quite careful with that. And the chart style here used is a slope chart showing just the change between 2000 and 2016 in selected countries which either had a big reduction in rates like the Central African Republic or an increase like South Africa, Kiribati, Guinea-Bissau. Okay, so that's a brief tour through the kinds of charts and tables you might see if you looked at a House of Commons Library publication, and how we start off with this very simple green shades style, but there are lots of ways to build on it and stretch it depending on the subject matter. And we're quite, liberal in terms of what we would do. We would always emphasise the point that the design you choose and the colours you choose should depend on your subject matter, and you shouldn't try and shoehorn everything into a single colour or a single style just because that's the corporate identity. Sometimes you will need to make different choices. Okay, so before I hand over back to Ollie, I'm going to show you a bit of our work on mapping. So this is something we've developed over the last few years. While charts and tables are something we've been doing for a long time, it's only in the last 3 or 4 years that all of our researchers have been able to make maps. It's now something that is almost sort of a baseline skill among our statistics teams, and that's been a good change. It's allowed us to have a lot more geographical analysis and visualization in our work, and a lot of that has been fueled by using a piece of open source software called QGIS that anyone can access. We're also helped by the fact that the UK has a lot of high quality open source geographical data on our National Statistics Geography Portal. I think a lot of countries have this. I don't know where you're at with that in Portugal, but if you have a lot of open data there, then there's often a lot of scope for visualization and analysis. So a lot of the maps we produce are quite standard national maps. Sometimes we just want to make a national thematic map and show how something differs across the population. So on the left, this is about cash machines, ATMs, as we call them. So how many free cash machines there are relative to the population size in every electoral constituency in the UK. And a lot of our maps will look something like this. And you'll notice that there's a colour scheme here which is sort of similar to our standard visual style, but even more so for maps than for charts, we are careful to choose a colour scheme that fits with the data rather than simply going with a default green, because as I mentioned, green isn't always appropriate when you're mapping something where the high values relate to something bad or negative. On the right, we've got a pool of a map linked to a graphic. So this is about fishing ports in the UK, and the largest fishing ports in the UK are shown on the map with numbers. And then you've got a bit of a silly graphic where this is shown as a kind of magnitude. So one fish here relates to, I think, 1,000 tons caught, and the numbers relate to the numbers on the map. I think both of those are online to look at. The right one's probably in the publication on fishing, but we can send you the link if you're interested in seeing the full-size version. But using maps simply and nationally is not the only thing we do. So this is an example of two maps which do something a bit more complex and interesting. The left is about prescribing of drugs for diabetes medicines, and it has a national map showing where the highest prescribing for diabetes is, and then a couple of insets with blurbs saying, highlighting areas where it's high rates, and in particular giving a bit of context for that. So prescribing is higher in areas with a high proportion of black and ethnic minority population, like parts of Leicester and the West Midlands. And then a couple more like that. And this is one where you've got a few labels and call-outs showing where the high areas are. And it's a selective map that only shading the areas with the high rates. So different approaches that go beyond a basic map. And not all our mapping is national. So this would be an example of a local map that we would produce for a constituency. So in this case, you've got lots of dots, and each one relates to a postcode or a zip code. And it shows how good the broadband connection, the internet connections is in that postcode, based on some very fine-grained open data published by our communications regulator. And this is mapped to an in-depth map of the constituency in order for the MP for this constituency to be able to look at the map and say which areas of my constituency have poor internet connections. And everything that you see here is built based on open data published by either our statistics authority or by our ordnance survey. So there's place names, roads, boundaries of our electoral constituencies, land use shading, and all that comes together to make a very detailed local map. And obviously the scope to be able to do this sort of thing, as I said, is dependent on the level of geographical data and open data that is available to you, and we're very lucky in the UK to have a lot of that. So I hope that was an interesting and useful tour through a bunch of our outputs, and particularly the kind that we've become able to do in the last few years. We would be very happy to discuss where they come from, show you better versions, bigger versions, and talk about how they're produced. This is really just a showcase to show you what we are doing, what we can do. And Ollie's going to talk more now about some interactive. So I'll just stop presenting, and pass over to Ollie.
Thanks, Carl. There we go. I will switch back to my computer. Yes, present desktop. So before, we're going to leave PowerPoint now, because what I'm going to show you now is all stuff that takes place in a web browser. Hang on one second. Present. Okay. Bear with me. I'm just waiting for this. Infinite regress. So let's just come down. So
there's a couple of things I need to say before we get into this. So one of the key things is when we started exploring using interactive visualizations, we had no hosting for them whatsoever. We literally just started doing things on whatever web space we could get, and sometimes we would actually set up web space specifically on our own outside of supported IT so that we could do what we needed to do fast enough. Some of the things I'm going to show you now, the first few things, aren't in the visual style that Carl has just showed you, because some of them predate that visual style. As that visual style has developed in our more recent interactive work, we've started incorporating elements of it. We don't always stick to it rigorously. Sometimes we do. We always try and use the same fonts now. Colors will depend on the context of the visualization. So it's important to understand that this work started off as very experimental work, with us literally trying to produce stuff in our own web pages and then moving towards something that had, where we were working in partnership with our IT teams to so that we could develop this work and host it and promote it inside official parliamentary websites. That work is still ongoing, as I'll explain in a moment. We still haven't got to the point where we can do everything we need within the parliament.uk domain in a supported way. So the first thing I'm going to show you is the very first interactive visualization that we ever produced. And this is completely outside of the style guide. It's not, it's on my own website. It's not on a Parliament website. But it's an interesting one to look at, because it goes to the question of why would you want to use an interactive chart rather than a static chart? People like interactive charts because they think they're kind of whizzy and neat. But we kind of take a view that there needs to be a good reason for interactivity. So what are the good reasons for interactivity? Well, in this particular case, migration is a very big subject of debate within the UK, and we have annual estimates of migration that are, you know, we show net migration on the order of around sort of 200,000 to 300,000 in any given year at the moment. And these statistics are often covered every quarter when they're published, and they're frequently misunderstood because the headline estimate of net migration comes with a very large confidence interval that people don't intuitively understand. So the headline estimates of net migration have a confidence interval of around plus or minus 40,000 on them, which means that sometimes when you think you're seeing a change, you're not. This is a point that we've often struggled to get MPs to understand, and you will often see newspapers in the UK reporting changes as if migration has gone up or down when the difference between any 2 years is not statistically significant. So this was done a few years ago, and this shows, I think it was done in 2013, so you've got the data to 2012, and it shows annual estimates of net migration to the UK in each year from 1998 to 2012. And when you see the chart in its static form like this, you're seeing the headline estimates. If you click on the chart, it generates a new chart using random numbers based on the actual estimated value and what it might have been given the confidence interval. So it's selecting values from within the uncertainty distribution surrounding that estimate with the frequency with which they arise. And what you notice when you show the chart in this way is that many of the patterns you see when it's static just completely disappear. And what you notice is that really there's only kind of two or three patterns that you can reliably notice. So in any given version of the chart, estimates since 2004 tend to be higher than estimates before 2004, because that's when migration from the accession states to the UK started. And similarly, you'll notice that in almost every version of this chart, migration in 2012 was lower than in 2010. So you know the increase from before 2004 to after 2004 is real, and you know the decrease from 2010 to 12 is real. But any of the individual changes within the years beyond that are suspect. So that was a way of illustrating how the statistical uncertainty in a set of estimates can affect how you interpret a chart. Other reasons you might choose to use an interactive visualization rather than a static one are that it lets you use new kinds of visualizations that aren't necessarily available in the things like Excel, and also the increased information density. So this is what's known as a tree map, and it's showing the foreign-born population of the UK by country of birth. So with the tree map, in the tree map, area is proportionate to size, to the size of the thing. And what we have here is we have all of the countries of the world grouped into one of the geographical groupings that our National Statistics Organization uses. So it's the light blue here at the top left, that's European Union countries. Yellow is South and East Asia. Pink is Africa, green is Americas and the Caribbean, orange is Middle East and Central Asia, blue is non-EU, Europe, light blue at the bottom right, and the pink, the dark pink purple is Oceania. So that's quite a neat way of showing a very large amount of information. It gives you the simple schematic at the top level, so you can see, well, non-EU is bigger than EU, but EU is the largest single geographic area of those seven. But then you can see within each one that what the big categories are. So India is one of the largest categories of non-EU. Polish is one of the largest categories of EU. And because where the interactivity helps is it means even when you can't see the labelling, you still can go and see what these very small areas, small countries are buried within the chart. So this would work, I think, reasonably well as a static visualization, but it's harder to produce without using D3, which is the JavaScript library we're using to do this. And you wouldn't be able to drill down in the same way if you were interested in, well, what is that country over here? Both of these were sort of early experimental interactive visualizations that we produced. We've now got to the point where we're able to put interactive visualizations onto the Commons Library website. So I mentioned earlier, commonslibrary.parliament.uk. This is our place on the web. It has articles. I'll just show you the homepage actually, so you can see. You can see this is what it looks like on the homepage. So we have articles and links to briefing material, and we have these, which are a set of dashboards. Now, these dashboards are not developed using custom JavaScript. These are developed using Power BI, and the only bit of JavaScript we're using here is to include the Power BI dashboards into our web page. So we have access to Power BI as part of our Microsoft subscription. Power BI lets you create a dashboard and publish it to a location on the web, and then we're pulling that into our own website using some JavaScript. And here again, what you can see, what this gives you is, this is the headline constituency dashboard, and again, it sort of increases information density to the extent that this becomes a tool. So you can choose a particular constituency and then it will give you the data for that constituency. These are much more kind of standardized widgets. These are things that Power BI supports. So Power BI is very powerful in that it lets you get a lot of information quickly into an interactive dashboard that people can use to explore facts about their constituency, but it's much more there's a lower barrier to entry. You don't need to know how to do any programming to use it, but then you're limited to the visualizations that Power BI supports. The next stage we want to get to with interactive visualizations is being able to do the kind of custom visualizations that we've shown here on the actual website itself, and we're close to doing that. So hang on, I need to pop this down so I can change the tab. This is a custom visualization done in D3 that is being shown on our website software. This is not live. This is a preview page I'm showing you now. And here we have a D3 visualization like the ones I've just shown you. What you're actually seeing here is the distribution of parliamentary constituencies by median age at the last general election. So this one shows you the constituencies distributed by median age and party. This one here shows you distribution by median age and turnout. So you can see that constituencies with higher median age tend to have higher turnout. And these are showing the Labour Party majorities and the Conservative Party majorities by age. So you can see Labour Party's highest majorities are in the constituencies with the youngest median age, while the Conservatives tend to be in the constituencies with much higher median age. Now, the key point about this is this lets us do the custom visualizations inside the blogging template itself, but we're still waiting for the hosting. This is currently being pulled off the central section of this page is being pulled from my own website. We're waiting for our IT department to give us the hosting so that we can put these visualizations online in a supported way, and that's why it's not live yet. But that hasn't stopped us. The fact that we've had to rely on our own hosting hasn't stopped us. I'm going to show you some tools we've built that help us with our research and help us provide information to MPs using interactive data visualization. So I have to keep doing this because I can't see the top of my screen. So this was the first interactive map we built that we sent to MPs, and this came out of a question that we got from an MP who wanted to know if there was a way of comparing parliamentary constituencies in terms of how separated their ethnic groups were. And by separation we mean, do they live in the same areas or do they tend to live in ghettos? We did some investigation. We found there is a statistical measure you can use that's called an index of dissimilarity, and you can use it to score how mixed geographically different groups in the population are. So what you see at this level are regional maps of parliamentary constituencies shaded by their separation score, where dark means a high degree of separation between different ethnic groups and light means a low degree of separation. Now, if you mouse over these, it will tell you which constituency it is. It'll give you the separation score, which is a value between 0 and 1, where 1 means completely separated, 0 means perfectly integrated, and their rank. If you click on one of these, this is the most ethnically separated constituency. At this level, it shows you the percentage of the population of that constituency in the non-white ethnic groups in the lower level areas. So you can see this is the constituency with the highest level of separation, where you have areas of the constituency which are almost 100% non-white and grouped together in this tiny small urban area, which is Dewsbury. And then in the rural areas around Dewsbury, there's almost 100% white. By contrast, if you want to look at the most ethnically integrated constituency, it's this one. It's Sutton and Cheam in London. And you can see that it's somewhere between sort of 15 and 30% of the population is non-white across the whole of the constituency. What's interesting is that this constituency, Sutton and Cheam, it's the same percentage of the population that's non-white as the constituency we just looked at, Dewsbury, which is the most separated. So in each case, it's about 21% of the population that's non-white. But in Sutton and Cheam, the non-white population is evenly distributed and mixed with the white population, whereas in Dewsbury, they're living almost exclusively apart. Now, this piece of work demonstrates some of the value of doing interactive work, I think, because you just have to write the code for each map for this level of the map once, and then you can just point it at different data sets and it can just generate the map. So having written the code to generate the data for one constituency, we can now, whenever an MP asks for the breakdown of their constituency by ethnic group, along with the table of data, we can also send them a map and say, well, this is, and here is how it's geographically distributed. So that was our first experiment at interactive mapping. It's nice, but there are some limitations to this. One of the big limitations to these maps is that you can't see the underlying geography. You can't see, it shows you the areas shaded, but you can't see which places on the map they correspond to. The next thing we built was a tool for producing population estimates for small areas. So one of the questions we get asked a lot is, people want to know the populations of areas that are, for which there's no kind of administrative boundary, the catchment areas of schools or certain neighbourhoods. So what this interactive application lets you do is it shows you some of the smallest areas in Great Britain for which we have population estimates, and it lets you build a population estimate. So here you can see the map of London underneath our boundaries, and you can select pieces of the jigsaw to add to create a population estimate. And you can see as I'm adding to this area for which I'm estimating the population, the total population is shown here in the top right. Having chosen an area, you can then go and get the data for that area by clicking Get Data. And here you can see a population pyramid where the white bars in the background show the age distribution within the country as a whole, and the shaded bars transparent over the top or translucent over the top show the population distribution in the area that you selected. So you can see in this area of central London I've selected, it skews more male than female, and it tends to be not many children, not many older people, more people concentrated in that kind of 20 to 50 age group. And this will work anywhere in Great Britain. So if we're interested in, I don't know, let's say a population of Cardiff Bay, we can just zoom into Cardiff Bay and then choose the areas that make up Cardiff Bay. And then go and get the data. And again, that's even more younger, 20 to 40, mostly young single people living in small flats. And then you can download the data. I won't do it, but if you click on the download data link, you can get the data underlying this as a spreadsheet for analysis. So that's, again, a useful way that when MPs want to know about, well, how many people live in each area and what's the age distribution, that gives us a way of doing that easily. I'll just show you one of my favourite things in Population Builder, which is this area here is it's the small area which contains one of Britain's most famous boys' boarding schools. And if you choose this area and get the data, you can see that about half the population are boys aged 10 to 20, and that's the area I always look at to check that I've updated the data correctly, because it's a very, very odd population pyramid for that area. The next one we did was similar. This is about, these maps were in order to provide information about what's known as the constituency boundary review. There's a proposal currently to change the number of constituencies and the number of MPs in the UK from 650 to 600. And that means every MP that currently sits in Parliament wants to know how the boundaries of their constituency are going to change. And the original plan was that we were going to have to create 650 individual maps for each set of proposals, and in the process there are three stages of proposals, so we're looking at making 2,000 individual maps. Instead, we developed a tool that lets you compare the old and the new constituencies. So here you've got the old, current constituencies in purple, you've got the proposed constituencies in blue. And you can see the wards, which are the electoral areas that make them up, are these thin black lines. And the value of this tool to us, first of all, it means it saves us making 2,000 maps. We just need to make one map for each region, and then we can send that map to whichever MP, to the region for which an MP is a member, so they can look at their data. But it also lets you come up with counter proposals to the suggestion. So when the boundary commissions ask for feedback from the public, if people want to suggest changes, this lets them come up with alternative proposals. And in order to come up with a new constituency, it has to be a certain size, it has to fall within a certain population electorate size. So a bit like Population Builder, this will let you choose wards to make a constituency. So you can see here I've chosen all of the wards in this blue constituency, which is the new proposed constituency for Romford, and the sum of the population in that area is shown up here as 77,329. If I bring the proposed area to the top, you look in the bottom right, you can see that the areas that I've selected agree with the electorate for that area. So that helps people understand how their constituencies are changing and how they could be alternatively arranged to produce new sets of constituencies. The last map I'll show you is the first map. If you notice the domain name here, it's visual.parliament.uk. This is the first map we've managed to develop and host in partnership with our own IT department. And this is a project that Carl's been doing to give some of those small areas we saw earlier meaningful names. One of the issues we have in providing local area data to members of parliament is that the areas for which data is published don't have natural names. They just have code names like Leeds 07 or Haringey 12 or things like that, names that don't mean anything to someone who knows the area. So Carl's been working on a data set of natural names, and what this application does is we're asking members of the public to look at the names we're proposing using for their areas and suggest improvements. So if you come to this particular map, you can click on it, and this is the currently proposed name for that area, 40 Lane, and you can say, well, actually locally it's known as reservoir or something like that, and so you can put in a suggestion and submit it, and we're crowdsourcing those suggestions in order to come up with a better set of names. And once we have a set of names we can use for our for reporting local area statistics, we're going to publish it as a data set for other people to use. So those are the ones I was going to show you this morning. Hang on, let me just stop presenting. Here we are. Hang on, how do I stop presenting? Hide stage. So that was a bit of a whirlwind tour of some of the work we've been doing. I hope it was all understandable, and I'm sorry if I've rushed through it a little bit, but I'm aware of the time. Is there anything that's unclear or about which you'd like to ask us questions?
No, I think it all was very clear. The mapping part, we're not required to do such detailed maps, so it's very different from what we do. But the first part of the presentation on the charts and tables was very useful, and it showed us we're at the same point as you were on 5 years ago. So it's interesting to it was very interesting to see how you. Built up on that the software part brings a lot of questions. Because I believe the background. It would be interesting to know about the background of the people working on your department, since to work with all of that software, maybe you need some kind of skills, technological skills. So that would be interesting to know.
Okay, so I have got a background in software development, and part of the data science program is about trying to develop those skills among our statistical researchers, so it's not just one person who knows them. There's about 25 researchers across social and general statistics and economic policy and statistics. They have a wide range of backgrounds. Some have economics degrees, some have psychology degrees, some have non-statistical degrees like English language or philosophy. But everyone here has to have a kind of a grounding in statistical literacy and to be able to demonstrate that in tests. There's no requirement for anyone who works in our sections to have software development skills, so there are a couple of us who do. So part of my work on the data science program is about running a training program to encourage those who are interested. No one's obliged to learn it, but anyone who's interested in learning it can learn it. So the teaching language we're using for people who don't have a background in programming is R, but the languages we actually use to do things include R, Python, and JavaScript. And I think as people get more familiar with programming in R, I think there'll be interest from different people in learning Python or JavaScript as well. I mean, JavaScript is useful because that's the language you need to do interactive data visualization online. Python is also very useful in the context of the geography stuff, because QGIS, which is the main software application we use for producing maps, has a plugin architecture that uses Python to write plugins. So if you know a bit of Python, you can take some of your workflows for QGIS and turn them into a plugin. So I'm anticipating that there'll be some interest in that. But currently, it's very much me that does the software development side of things, although the skills, people are now sort of developing those skills, and people are kind of accelerating quite quickly.
Hello, Oli.
Hi.
Hi. I'm Fernando from the research.
Hi.
Thank you so much for your presentation, an interesting presentation. And thank you to Dalila that created the opportunity for this discussion. At the research department, we are just in the beginning. We have to improve, we have to use more graphic elements in our publications, in our documents. Namely, in the parliamentary activity report, we use a lot of data, of parliamentary data, that we have to show in a better way, in a more attractive way. My question is, if you do you have some free apps or websites that we can use for this beginning process we are trying to build?
I think so the one place that I would highly recommend starting is, there's a book, it's not a website, it's a book called Data at Work. And Data at Work is all about how to use Excel to make really first-class visualizations. There is actually an awful lot you can do with Excel in terms of making visualizations for print. And this book, Data at Work, if you look, I can't remember the name of the author, but if you type that into Amazon, you'll find mm-hmm. a copy. That's really excellent on the question of how do you make publication quality graphics using Excel. So I think there's a lot you can do with the kind of the core tools. In terms of websites, it depends what you're trying to do. If you want to make interactive visualizations without learning to program, two websites that are worth looking at are Tableau. I don't know if you've come across that one. And the other is a website called Flourish. I think it's flourish.io.
The first one was?
Tableau. T-A-B-L-E-A-U.
Thank you.
And then the other one's called Flourish. Flourish.io. And both of those websites will let you create online visualizations that you can share with people. And I think they both have a free tier and they both have a paid for tier. So you can start doing things anyway, and then you can start doing things without having to pay any money, and just stuff that will go publicly on the web and you can send a link to someone. Or if you start using and relying on those tools, then you have the option of paying for them. I think we used Tableau for a while, for a couple of years. We had a number of those interactive constituency dashboards I showed you in Power BI, mm-hmm. those were done using Tableau originally. We've now moved over to Power BI. I don't know if you have... If your IT department is paying Microsoft for services, it's quite likely you might be able to get Power BI as well. And that, if you know how to use Excel, it's very easy to translate those skills into using Power BI. There's lots you can do with Power BI in terms of getting nice visualizations online. Again, if you have Power BI as part of your Microsoft subscription, then you won't need to pay anything to start using it. There are a few other online tools you can use. I think there's one called Sankey-matic for producing those kind of, we didn't look at Sankeys today, but for producing those kind of flow charts where you can see, you know, what proportion of a particular group flows into different categories and things like that. That's called Sankey-matic, Sankeymatic. Carl, can you think of any? Oh, is Carl there? Oh, he's putting his headphones back on. Carl?
Yes, sorry, go on. Noah was just reminding me that raw graphs is also a good thing to look at.
Okay, raw graphs. R-A-W, is that R-A-W?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
G-R-A-F-S, A-P-H-S.
Yeah, that's right.
Raw graphs. Okay, cool.
The other one you mentioned before, Sankey-matics?
Sankey-matic. I think that's right. Let me just check it now. I can send you these URLs if that's helpful, Dalila.
That would be better, yes.
Yeah, okay. I'll send you some URLs afterwards for some online tools.
Yeah, Oli?
Hi.
Another question, please. I would like to ask you. Dalila has mentioned, what resources are allocated to this work? Do you have a team of visualization of graphic designers and statisticians working together? Can you explain more?
Yeah, the work detailed? I would say. So every statistical researcher in those two statistics sections is expected to be able to produce high quality visualizations in print using Excel. Everybody's expected to do that, and when we recruit, we will train people in both our visual style, but in generally how to use Excel to make nice looking things. And the general workflow we have now is make things in Excel, and then if you need to do more complicated annotation and layout, export it as a PDF and then take it into Inkscape so that you can work with it as an SVG and label it up, and then from there export it again. Inkscape's completely free. It's open source software. You don't have to pay for it. It's the open source version of Illustrator. So the basic workflow for statisticians is Excel and Inkscape. That's the kind of core workflow. All of the other stuff like QGIS and the D3 and R, that's all very much kind of, that's the added extra. That's not something we expect people to know. Where we probably stop, we concentrate very much on what we think of as statistical visualizations. There's a whole set of work which I think could better be described as infographics, and that tends to be done by the communications team rather than the statistics team. So if you're interested in, if we're talking about ways of showing processes where you might have a label and an arrow pointing to something, that we wouldn't do that. We tend to produce things where there is quantitative data to display. The more kind of infographic type work is falls outside of our scope, I would say. Would you say that's right, Carl?
I would say it can be a bit of a grey area, but if there's no data involved, if the infographics involve statistics, then we'll probably be involved somehow. But if they don't, if it's more sort of visualizing a process, or for instance, how legislation goes through Parliament, or something else rather than just statistics, then that'll probably be handled by the communications team. But yeah, it can be a bit of a grey area.
For instance, I can give one example. The communications team commissioned a graphic designer to produce, I think it was about 10 or 20 sort of visualization templates for tweeting key pieces of data. So you've got certain statistics that come out on a regular timetable, the migration statistics, the GDP statistics, the employment statistics, and they paid a graphic designer to sort of come up with a kind of something that they could just plug numbers into every quarter. We advised them, they showed us the work of the graphic designer, and we advised them on the statistical elements of the presentation, but we didn't do that ourselves.
Thank you.
Oli, I think that wraps up our questions. Thank you very much. It was really very useful. Do you have any plans for continuing to build up on your work?
I think one of the key things for us is getting that, for me certainly, is getting the processes around interactive visualization more sort of less ad hoc and experimental and more routine. One of the things I would like to do is be able to embed interactive visualizations directly inside website articles where it makes sense to do so. I think the other thing that people are experimenting with is automatically generating charts, writing scripts in R to generate charts for routine briefing. So those are both areas of interest, and I think trying to find ways of incorporating, I suppose the third thing would be thinking about those things we can't do in Excel for static publication, where you could use one workflow we haven't talked about that I know the Financial Times relies on very heavily for its visualization and visual journalism, is a workflow where you use D3, which is that library we were using to generate interactive graphics. You can actually use that to generate static graphics, and where you have more sophisticated kinds of visualizations like network diagrams or tree maps or Sankey diagrams, That's also an area of interest for us. But I think we'll always build out from that stuff you saw in the first half of the presentation, which is what's our core look and feel, what are the principles of visual design that we're going to apply, do we have a way of letting researchers do that easily and quickly, and then the other stuff is very much the icing on the cake.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. We've enjoyed it, I think, and I will send you a follow-up email with some links. And if you have any further questions, feel free to email me.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye.